welcome to The Neighbor Next Door, a podcast about the power and importance of neighboring. I'm your host, Matthew Johnson, and as usual, I am joined on the virtual front porch by my colleague and neighboring, Adam Barlow Thompson.
Oh, hey, hi. Sorry. I thought there were going to be more there. Hey, good neighbors. Welcome to the front porch. We are wide awake on this Monday morning as we're recording. And
yeah,
and we are continuing our series with an interview from Cormac Russell, who is a leading voice in asset-based community development and the author of Rekindling Democracy. We are in episode 4 of this series. And Matt, you want to try to give us some, let's see how good Matt is at recapping here.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So a recap of 1 through 3 in no more than 2 minutes.
Okay. All right. 1 through 3, they were awesome. All right. Back to you, Adam. So where are we going next?
Hey, I'll just fill in a little around the edges, if you don't mind. So episode 1, we did some talk about institutions and how those, like what roles those play, and as well as kind of the false dichotomy of institutions versus community, which sometimes those in our field get accused of. In episode 2, he introduced this idea of the 3-lane highway, and that highway is a metaphor for how we can impact communities. And what Cormac uses, and this is rooted in that asset-based community development work that we've been doing for a long time, the first lane is the communities do the work themselves. People in the neighborhoods, in the communities, do the work themselves. The second lane is citizens can do that work with institutions, like institutions support the citizens in doing the work. And then the third lane is that institutions are, there is some work that they're going to do on their own because they're set up to do that. So that was in episode 2. Episode 3 then was kind of stories of how we see that happening in the world. And he talked about an amazing story of a hospice and the way how that interacted with the community during this season of COVID, which is, I think, a great illustration, as well as like parenting during this, with the how parents and the institution of our schools have had to interact differently during COVID. And so he gave us some narratives of how those 3 lanes actually work in the community. So thanks to Matt for his wonderful recap that I had to do.
And so that was totally worth it. I'm so glad I said that.
What are we going to do this episode? And I'm really hoping you don't screw me over here.
No, I won't. Okay, so this episode, we're going to talk about economics. And Cormac starts to unpack, and he alludes to the fact he's actually maybe writing another book about this, but he starts to unpack what does this conversation around community assets and sharing of gifts, how does that show up, or what does that look like in the context of a capitalistic society and an individualistic society. And I think I find this segment really, it's profoundly insightful to me, because he's not anti-capitalism. He's not anti-money. This is about rediscovering something, I think, that's a bigger container that capitalism can fit inside of. So that's what we're going to dig into today.
So yeah, we're going to play some audio from that original interview, and then Matt and I will come back on and, talk about what we've heard at different parts of that. So here we go.
All right.
Hey It's interesting to, again, think about economics beyond the individual. Without getting too much into it, and it's something I'll write about separately, but if you take this idea of C.B. McPherson, the great Canadian academic, wrote a book in 1955 called Possessive Individualism, where he basically says, look, Locke and Mill really messed it up for us, because they introduced this whole idea of the individual, and they just went to town on this, you know. And they kind of felt they had to, because they had to break away from, you know, narratives around theology and whatever. So they felt they had to get into this really heavily. But we've inherited that idea that individualism is largely a property right, you know. So our money is our money. It's my property. My opinions are mine. So we have all of these currencies, and see, in terms of polarization at the moment, you know, it's this elevated idea that I am entitled to my opinions, and it doesn't matter at what expense or to whom, you know. It's the joke of Anne Lamott I love, you know, when she says, you know that you've invented God in your own image, when he, she hates all the same people as you. So, you know, it's the same with money. You know, money is just a story, as we know. So as a human construct, this idea that money is my property within which I advance my personal agendas at whatever expense I determine to be appropriate is a really, really dangerous idea. But it's not one that I came up with personally. It's one that was constructed and I was born into. So that's the sea in which I swim. And, you know, I think, again, lots of liberals will say, well, thank goodness we've got the public sector and we've got charities, because they don't operate that way. Well, actually, they do. So they, you know, the structure of the institution is essentially around this idea of, I'm going to take your need in whatever shape or form it comes, and I'm going to structure it in such a way that it can be commodified, you know. So 2/3 of all money that are intended to go to people living in poverty, in other words, to end poverty, don't go to people living in poverty in the US. They go to people who are servicing people who live in poverty, who are not poor. So, you know, so we really need to be careful not to bask in our own piety, you know, and start pointing fingers at the corporate sector and say, how greedy are these people? Well, yeah, you know, it's different degrees of, but we've got all the same exoskeletons. And many of the big churches are exactly the same, where they're harvesting people's misery and turning it into money. You know, you've got a mental health problem, don't worry. Because, you know, pharmacology and mental health institutions and enforcement, and, you know, there are lots and lots of jobs around your mental health issue. And this is important, because I think sometimes we kind of think about the marketplace as the problem and forget that the human side of the marketplace is many of these institutions that we've created, who have a gloss or an air of goodness, of sanctity about them. But when you get right down to it, you know, the question is always, well, if the person that you're helping had your salary, would they use it to buy the help you're offering them? And the answer is 99% of the time, no.
Okay, let's just take a pause here for a second. I'm just gonna.
Yeah, let's just read that. Let's like read that one quote back here.
Yeah, and I think he started it actually mentioning mega churches.
I know.
And then he's like, "Yeah, they're harvesting people's misery and turning it into money."
Ooh. Dang. With that silky Irish accent all on top of it. Like, right. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Just not sure what to do with that, Matt. Someone who went into professional ministry and works at a professional nonprofit and makes my money, you know, by donations and commodifying something.
some need in our community or in individuals. Yeah. Yeah. So I want to offer just a word of compassion and pointing back then, because in one of our earlier episodes in interviewing Cormac, he made a comment even of like, when you woke up in the morning and you were 16 years old and you wanted to make the world a better place, you probably didn't envision doing what you're doing. And I think that's really important. So for those, I just want to offer a word, I think, to those in the public sector who are providing services. There's deep truth in what Cormac says. And so I think the question or the opportunity is for us all to say like, I'm motivated by compassion. I do care about my community. That's what got me to do this work, whatever that work is. But that exoskeleton that he talked about, right, has twisted that. And so the invitation is for all of us to look at those three lanes, to say, okay, I've been in the third lane. I've been focusing on what my institution can do as a service provider. Right. And we don't have to drive that car into the ditch, but let's slow down. Let's move to the first lane and let's go into our communities and start to explore. Mm-hmm. What are the gifts and assets in the community? What can citizens in this community do on their own? And like, let's encourage them to do that and to live into that.
Yeah. And he talks about this in that little clip, like so much of our training, the pressures that are around us make it easier and make it seductive just to stay in that lane of institutional control and institutional overreach, mm-hmm. because you can't control it. You can't, there is a lot, like the narrative's easier to tell in many ways. But we have to resist that and be willing to slow down so that we can merge and focus our attention on that first lane. Mm-hmm. So this is where, Cormac is great because he really rips the bandaid off, right. Matt and I will come along after and, you know, nurse you back to a place where you can hear the truth that is in that sick burn. So,
yes. Yeah, let's hope so. Let's hope so. You and I are we're the Neosporin of this situation, hopefully.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Maybe just a side note there, because I do find Cormac to be very compassionate and understanding. So like he's dropping the burns, but also, he's
I mean, it's also like why he's the like international voice of this, though, is because he's willing to really like put it out there and say it in that bold kind of way.
Yes. So,
there's a lot of courage in that.
Absolutely. All right. Let's jump back in then, because he's going to start to talk about just money and then how we've lost the exchanging of gifts or the sharing of our gifts.
Money somehow is doing something that we used to do with gift exchange and within a culture of community that's causing a perversion. It's causing the opposite of relationality. And, you know, the anthropological view or the old ways, if you want to put it that way, would say, I'm just thinking out loud here, but you take, for example, the pandemic of the last while, kind of like a rite of passage. It had three clear stages: leaving home or being disconnected from the community, which we've all experienced to a greater or lesser extent, the trial, again, greater or lesser extent, and then the returning. This was done in Indigenous communities as a way to make sure that we don't fall into the snare of the marketplace or the allure of money. The idea was that we would go away from the home and experience a trial for the purposes of discovering our, what the North African communities would call our genii, from which the word genius comes. In other words, what gift have I got to contribute to the well-being of my community? And then I return home with that knowledge and with the community's willingness to receive my gift. Now, that's the kind of economy that I'm talking about. Now, within that economy, you can do all kinds of things with money still. So I'm not prepared to be drawn and arguing against capitalism. That ship has sailed. But if we organize at neighborhood level, we can, for example, as has happened in Australia, where there are 317 local Bendigo banks, we can take money that we've used to capitalize our mortgages, and we can actually start reinvesting them into local banks where we actually receive the surety of the bank at the end of the year, and we invest that back into young people's ideas for making the neighborhood a better place, which makes it more likely that they'll want to stay and that they'll buy their own properties when they have, you know, when they have kids, family themselves. So I think that's just an example of saying it's not binary. It's not like, you know, we're looking not just for an alternative economy, but an alternative to the economy. But we're saying that, you know, the economy is not the issue. When the economy is embedded in society, as we see, you know, it works pretty well. It's when it becomes grotesque and it becomes disembedded from society, it starts to eat its children. It starts to envelop. And we don't, our culture starts to be what's essentially swallowed up. And we're seeing that now a lot, I think. The new currency won't be money. I think it'll be data. And our kids are being trained really, really early on. Around giving over their identity, their digital identities, very, very early on, through gaming, seeming innocuous, but it's a form of addiction. And it's a new form of addiction. You know, it's kind of really predatory.
All right. There's a ton of really wonderful stuff right in there. Two things. So I think I want to work backwards, because he just makes this quick reference to the new currency won't be money, it will be data. And the kids are being basically groomed to be addicts, to give their attention, their digital attention to corporate sponsors through gaming. Okay, that's massive. That's a massive observation. So the good news is we've already done a podcast on this a little bit.
Thank goodness.
So
enough heavy stuff for this episode.
If you haven't seen the documentary, The Social Dilemma, basically I think unpacks this idea that right. Businesses are paying to keep the attention of individuals, and the younger they can start, the better. So we did a podcast on that. I recommend the movie. I recommend the podcast, both things to check out.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting in that statement is that what's really happening with that when it comes to gift exchange is that it's another thing that keeps gift exchange from happening, because we give our attention to this digital world that is not embedded in our society in the way that, using that language again that he used, and it takes it, there's no, you're not giving or you're not exchanging gifts with anyone through those video games, or if you're not, I mean, it's not just kids. I mean, I know plenty of adults who are just as addicted to maybe not a video game, but their social media or some other online, interface. And so, and all of that takes our attention away from the things that are required for gift exchange in your neighborhood, which are relationships, seeing each other as abundantly gifted, cultivating that relationship of joy with your neighborhood. So yeah.
Yeah.
All of those come into play with that.
Yes. Yeah. So that's point number one, just from this like Woo! Tiny segment. Now, okay. Here's the other thing that he says that just blew my mind, and I am still sitting with it, that he points out that the pandemic has served as an anthropological rite of passage, leaving home, facing the trial in order to discover the gift, and then returning home in order to share the gift you've discovered for the greater good. Now, here's my question. I'm going to throw you a curveball, Adam. I want to know, if you look back over 2020, do you feel like you have greater clarity around your gifts?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. In some ways, I think I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, there's mm-hmm. definitely, and I don't know if I would blame that on the pandemic or if it's because of like other aspects of my life. But I mean, I think that's a legit, I'm curious what the like population writ large would say to that. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of people out there who do think who've, you know, because of the pandemic, let go of some things.
Yep.
They had to let go of, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's suffering. That's suffering, right?
Right. Right.
I didn't have any choice. I had to give this up.
It's like, and then once you trim down, you like, there's a few things you like are not willing to let go of because you love them very much.
Mm-hmm.
And they're too important to let go of.
Right. Because they're authentic. Clarifies
because they're authentic to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn that. Here's the thing about Matt Johnson that people need to know. I was listening to this just now and realized I was like, oh, because Matt's been talking about this whole, you know, go on the journey thing. He's ever since Cormac said it, he's like, oh, that's really important. We need to pay attention to that. And then I was like, yeah, of course, Matt thinks that's important. This is the guy who went and walked 500 miles across Spain, who loves pilgrimage of all kind, who's, yes. you know, always writing songs about finding our way and whatever. Like, yeah, of course, Matt's interested in this. So, okay, go ahead, Matt. Enlighten us. Why do you think this is so great?
Oh, man. Well, honestly, just, I mean, I'm really glad that you had an answer for that question that I threw at you. This would have been much less interesting if you'd been like, no, I don't think I've gained any clarity. But, you know, when I look back at 2020, like I would not choose 2020 as a year. And I have gained a ton of clarity around my own gifts and what I care about. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait a minute, what if that's true for many of us? And part of it is what, you know, like now it's informing what I say yes and no to.
Yeah.
But also like, I think there's this really pregnant question before us of how do we make sure that our communities are open for people and encouraging people to share the gifts that they are discovering about themselves. Okay. To me, that's the heavy question in this, like, because we are like on this real bumpy movement, like kind of through and out of COVID, right? And I'm using all kinds of language there because it's like, who knows, right? But we don't know the trajectory or timeline. But as we move out of it, I think there's certainly for me a sense of like, okay, we're not going back to the old normal. We're moving forward towards something. And I'm hearing in what Cormac shares this idea of like a society that says, you know, in the process, even in the process of reopening and rebuilding, let's start with the question of like, what have you discovered about yourself throughout your life and even in the last year,
right?
That you want to bring to the table that maybe you haven't brought to the table before, or that wasn't as central as you want it to be now. So, yeah, I mean, to me, this is just, it's a huge question I don't have an answer for, but I think we have to be asking it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. In the meantime, I'm just going to keep writing songs about it.
Okay. Now, yeah.
With that being said, we're going to jump back into our interview with Cormac, because then he does talk about what he's interested in, and where communities are experimenting with these kinds of questions, right? Which I think is just great stuff.
So I think in all kinds of ways, what I'm interested in is how do communities begin to say, okay, well, if we take seriously the idea of, you know, helping everybody here to feel productive, to feel they have a contribution, how would we organize ourselves and our assets to enable that to happen? You know, when people die, for example, is it possible not alone to leave their property, their money to individuals or to estates or foundations, but to an area, you know? And again, in Nebraska, Community Foundation have found ways that you can do that. If I've got three kids and I'm raising them in a small town where our biggest export is our children, could I convince myself and my neighbors to imagine into a situation where the town becomes my fourth child, and I'm prepared to capitalize the town up front in the hope that maybe one, two, or three of my children will grow up and are able to actually remain there. So these are the things that I want to open up. I call that a neighborhood economy, which is different from a philanthropic economy or, you know, kind of a uber capitalist economy. But I'm not going to be drawn in competing against these things because I think we'll lose. I'm just more interested in kind of, if we get to the edge of empire and we start growing some of this stuff for fun, what would that be like, you know?
Yeah, I think the way you've even stated that, being drawn into competing, like, every time I've brought one of these kind of ideas up in a place, people on either side of political spectrums will try to draw me into the same old fight that we've always been having. And I think they're missing that, no, this is something completely different than either side, in kind of our American context at least, either of those sides are fighting for, which is why when I first saw your book and I went onto the website and Cormac had this thing on his website where he was like, why did you choose to read this book? And I said, because it seems like something Americans, especially in our divide, need. And then Cormac out of the blue emails me back, which I was like, I just thought I was going to get some auto response from his website. And he emails me back and he's like, thanks for your thought. I'd love to talk more about that. And I just, first of all, I'm blown away that that email popped up in my inbox. And so thank you for that, that response, and then giving us a way to push against those kind of expected fights that everybody wants to have or are addicted to in a similar kind of way, but aren't really getting us anywhere. So,
yeah. I think there's, absolutely. And it's that sense of when we get beyond opinion and get into, at the speed of trust, get into an actual relationship with each other. Even the most tricky characters care about something that I could work with them on. And I think when we have a context like a neighborhood within which to contain that possibility and shape that possibility, then, you know, the opinions become much more malleable and much more negotiable. Whereas I feel that when we're talking about things at the scale of the nation state or at the scale of left, right, or whatever, it's just a scale that takes humanity and takes compassion and just puts it through the meat grinder, you know, and it comes out in all kinds of not so pleasant ways.
Yeah, let's end right there on the meat grinder.
Meat grinder's always a good place to cut it off. That's what listening to this podcast is like. It's like going through the meat grinder.
I feel like we need a sound effect for that. Crunch, 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 crunch. Oh, man. So a couple quick things in there. I just... So... First of all, the Nebraska Foundation that he mentions, which does do amazing work and has mm-hmm. been playing in that space of how do we invite people to bring their gifts and assets to the table for the greater good of our town or community.
And then, but
I love his invitation, like, let's just go to the edge of Empire and have fun with it and see what happens.
That's a great, I think, like we've tried to follow that example in our work a lot. You know, we have created in spaces where people generally didn't care that we were creating things because there was just like, for people who had something at stake, they're like, well, we don't care if you play with that. Like, you can, that's fine. You can do that. Yes. And what we found again and again is when you go out to that space and create something there that's wonderful, then it draws the attention of the center of Empire and the places that do have power, and suddenly they start to see it differently. And in some ways, they in a negative sense, sometimes they'll try to steal the good out of that. But in many ways, they find ways to incorporate it and slowly incorporate that kind of thought and change and processes into what already had existed. And that's beautiful.
Yeah, that is. That's a good word. That's a good word, because it doesn't have to be, again, as Cormac said, it's not binary. It's not, you know, and there are people within those institutions and systems that really care about people, care about communities, and want to see something different happen. And there's kind of just encouragement and permission. I like the way that you said that, like, let's look for those places that are overlooked, that are abandoned. If we go into those places with a lens of giftedness, right, looking for the abundance, the assets that are already present, and begin to look for how could those be shared, and then just see what emerges, see what comes up. I think that's really powerful.
Right. And it is fun. I mean, he uses that word, like, what did he say? Something about joy, right? I can't remember.
Oh,
I think maybe just said play with it. Let's play with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it does. It has that sense of like play, of fun, of joy, because for some reason at the edge of Empire, the stakes don't feel quite as high, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you are free to fail in like a really like pure way. And that I think lends to like that ability just to keep it light and see what happens. And if it doesn't work out, who cares? They already kicked us out of the Empire. So it's like, whatever, what else could they do?
Demote us more? No, it's not possible.
Yeah.
Good. Wow. Okay. Anything else, Adam?
I think that's good. We cranked out a lot of episode there, so we should probably wrap it up here.
All right, friends. Well, thank you again for joining us on the front porch for this conversation with Cormac Russell. Again, this podcast is a production of The Neighboring Movement, and you can learn more about our work by visiting www.neighboringmovement.org, where you'll find our blog and neighboring tips and other resources that we have created. Our podcast team includes Adam and I, as well as Christopher Swanson and Jenna Moody, who does all of our editing work. And special thanks to her when she's doing so much work to pull these Cormac Russell interviews together. It's great. So thank you, Jenna, for that work. And finally, the music that you hear in the background is by Brutal Bear. Until next time, happy neighboring.
Happy neighboring.